Hello, welcome to the Unseen and Chapman podcast on The Athletic. As usual, we'll bring you exclusive insight and stories from David and our team of writers. Coming up today, ahead of a crucial few weeks for Liverpool's scouting department, Simon Hughes joins us to tell us how it all works. Chris Waff is on the Newcastle beat for us and will tell us how Newcastle may have finally found a way to get the most out of Joel Linton, and also to discuss the continued uncertainty surrounding the ownership of Mike Ashley. To read all the articles we discuss on today's pod in full, just go to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman to subscribe for just £1 a month for 12 months, and you can cancel at any time. So you can access all of The Athletic all year long, and it means you'll get all our podcasts ad-free. The offer runs until the 4th of December, and it's for new subscribers only. So go to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman, and you'll get The Athletic for 12 months for £1 a month. David's YouTube show, Ask Ornstein, continues this week. Subscribers can submit questions in the comments section of David's weekly column on The Athletic, and I'll be back on this podcast feed on Thursday alongside Matt Slater with our new podcast, The Business of Sport. Right then, David, let's start the pod with Arsenal. There we go.
Who would have thought it?
Who would have thought it? You spoke to one of their invincibles for The Athletic.
Yeah, Freddie Ljungberg, it was an absolute pleasure. Of course, he came back to Arsenal in 2018 to work with the under-23s, having been away working at Wolfsburg as assistant manager there. Prior to that, he'd been working with the even younger Arsenal players, I think the under-15s. And it was all kind of Arsene Wenger's plan to keep Freddie Ljungberg, you know, progressing in his coaching career and with that Arsenal connection. Very quickly, he was promoted to the first team setup under Unai Emery in a swap with Steve Bould, and he was seen as a conduit to help the young players like Bukayo Saka making their way into the first team, and also work with the experienced players because he's got vast experience and pedigree and respect from his achievements himself. He then took interim charge, as we know, this time last year when Emery was sacked. Results didn't really pick up, but he certainly brought smiles back onto faces, bit of a connection, a really good result away to West Ham. He thought he was building something, but he also says to me in the interview that we did that he kind of knew that he was only ever temporary. He was denied an assistant, which showed him that it was he was only holding fort for the permanent successor. Despite that successor being somebody his junior and with not much more experience in Mikel Arteta, he then worked under Mikel Arteta in a quite a curious role on match days. We would see him going and sitting in the back of the stand, and he explains precisely what that role was in the interview that we did. He then left the club in August to pursue his own management career, and that's yet to launch. He's carefully considering where that's going to be, with which team, which project, which ownership. He's a really diligent process that he's going through to make that decision. But one of the key things I wanted to speak to him about, having been in the Arsenal setup over the last couple of years, seen it intimately at close quarters on the training pitch, the match pitch, in the dressing room, is what's wrong, what they're lacking. And that's especially pertinent after what we saw on Sunday evening and some of their recent results. And he pinpoints one area, actually. So I think we can listen to some of that now.
Winning is everything. There's nothing else than winning. I see it in some of the players that they have this winning edge and stuff. But I think if you look in the future for players, and there should be players that have won things and have that hunger, because it's a big difference. I've seen it, or you've probably seen it in players that win and players that don't always win, and that's just a big mentality. But then what Arsenal should or shouldn't do, like, that's totally up to them that sits in those power positions today to do that. And I just want it to go well and for them to get back to winning things. That's how I see it.
So it's a winning culture that needs to be through recruitment and around the club. And in the individuals,
yeah, I mean that's just how it is. And like I'm saying, it's not winning is not so easy. But it's for me, it's a lot of mentality. And I don't mean that the players don't want to win. It's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying that you can, look at individuals and stuff that have that. And some we say they didn't behave so well when they lost the game in a training session, for example, when we played. But yeah, then on a Saturday, there was nothing else than winning. And it is different ways of doing it. And like I said, I see it in some of the players as well. So it's not there. But I would say that would be something that I would focus on a lot.
And you would have seen that through all of your players when you were playing, and or almost all of them, and that's what needs to happen now. But do they have the footballing quality there at the moment, or does that also need to improve?
Of course, they have very, very good football players. Don't get me wrong. Like, you look at an Aubameyang, like, he's a top player. You have some very, very good players there. I think, for example, Tierney, I think, is going to be great for the club. Like, he has definitely that winning edge. You can see, you saw that against Leeds after the game. I couldn't say too much on TV, but... And like Ben Leno, like the saves, yeah, he down saves them often. Like, they have some top players. And then you have like the young ones coming through that, in my opinion, are amazing talents. So you have something there, like, you can totally build on it and do well. So just give them time and hopefully it comes.
So that's pretty timely given what happened yesterday. What's going to happen with Arsenal, both in this January's transfer market and in the summer, and how much of it is going to be dependent on Champions League football?
Oh, it's a huge unknown at the moment. You know, we did a big piece on The Athletic recently about the ownership, the Kroenkes. We explained how they have invested with their own money for the first time, really, since they became involved in Arsenal in 2007. And that was with the signing of Thomas Partey, where Stan Kroenke invested. They paid the 50 million Euros release clause, and I don't think they would be averse to investing again in the future if the right opportunity is there. Certainly, I think they're quite keen to look at release clauses. A lot has been spoken about Dominic Szoboszlai, I think I've pronounced that correctly, of Salzburg, but Arsenal won't be the only team in the mix for him. There is admiration there, but as is explained in a piece on The Athletic by Tom Warville, there are some reservations too. He's very young and raw, and they need to be absolutely convinced. Although that release clause, from what I seem to recall, 25 million euros seems incredibly low for a player of his talent and future potential. I've spoken before how their sort of longer term plans, which are kind of geared around the summer of 2021, are on that creative player, a kind of number 10. We know that Mesut Ozil will be at the end of his contract, and so heading out of the Emirates Stadium, and they have really lacked creativity. And then also a right-sided central defender, because David Luiz might be coming to an end. Certain other players like Sokratis, Mustafi could leave as well. Looking at recent performances, you may say that Arsenal need more work than that, and they may look to escalate some of that to January if the right opportunities are there. It's a really difficult time at Arsenal, but, you know, they're going to have to stick together. We've seen what talent they do have. They won the FA Cup. They claim some big victories. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang's going through his first real dip since he joined Arsenal, and they don't have many other routes to goal scoring, and so they're going to have to hope that he plays himself back into form, that they can find some supply to him, that they get Thomas Partey back sooner rather than later from injury, because central midfield looks weak, and that they continue to sort of stay solid at the back, because until recently they had the Premier League's best record defensively. It's a really difficult time. They've got Tottenham away in their next league match, and so, yeah, a lot of scrutiny. There will of course be some pressure building on Mikel Arteta externally, but internally I think he has total backing, and Arsenal will want to give it time. They won't want to become a club that chops and changes managers. You know, on the whole, I really like what I've seen from Mikel Arteta, but there are going to be some bumps in the road. He's a rookie manager, and Arsenal as a club and as a team have a lot of questions to answer at the moment.
Okay, that's Arsenal done with. Newcastle to come in a bit, but next Liverpool.
The first time I interviewed Neymar, he was 14.
He was pretty much famous, approaching household name status before he'd even played for the Santos first team.
Barca should have been better prepared. They really did not have a contingency plan for if Neymar were to leave.
You have the French president, Emmanuel Macron, calling it really good news on the day.
Without selling Coutinho for that amount of money, Liverpool's recent history would be very, very different.
But then again, Neymar changed the whole dynamic.
I'm Adam Leventhal, and this is Beyond the Headline. Neymar, the transfer that changed the world. Over the next three episodes, we will explore Neymar's €222 million move from Barcelona to Paris Saint-Germain, a transfer that changed the game not only because it more than doubled the world transfer record, but explain how the ripple effects made it arguably the most significant transfer in the history of the game. That's Beyond the Headline, available wherever you get your podcasts or get it ad-free via the Athletic app.
Now, with injuries in the transfer window set to open, these are going to be crucial weeks for Liverpool and their scouting department. The Athletic's Simon Hughes has written a huge piece on how the whole operation works. Joins us now. Great piece, Simon. It is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. But, let's deal with the big story. Marine, where you were a ball boy as a kid, into the third round of the FA Cup. We're recording this before the draw. But that, like, genuinely, that is massive.
Unbelievable. I mean, at the start of the season, you know, it was a lot of frustration about the club, because I still go there, you know, when I can, when work permits. And obviously with the pandemic stopping last season when they were doing well, and I don't think that the FA Cup was necessarily a priority at the start of the season. And 27 years ago, I think that they reached the third round and got Crewe Alexandra. And then had they beaten Crewe, these are played Blackburn Rovers when Kenny Dalglish was manager. Right. And the story at that time was Marine's manager, Ollie Howard, was Kenny Dalglish's window cleaner. But Marine lost at Gresty Road 3-1, so that tie never came about.
But if they're in need of a ball boy or ball man, could they call upon?
I think I said after they got to the first round, I'll only do it if I get to hold the captain's hand as I go out.
Let's move it back to Liverpool, shall we? Before we delve into your article as well, what did you make of Jurgen Klopp's post-match interview on Saturday?
It was a competitive discussion. I sort of enjoyed watching a little bit, but I didn't sort of buy into the whole thing on Twitter that it was one, you know, great sort of TV that we want, because I'd rather just see a great game of football, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it was obviously provoked by a particularly unfair comment from Jurgen Klopp, which provoked the discussion.
Do you mean the James Milner hamstring?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he can be like that sometimes. It's not the first time he's been like that since he's been Liverpool manager. I think that's what you get with Jurgen Klopp. You get sort of the joy of football and when Liverpool play very well, and you can see how much he loves it. But I think when somebody loves football so much, when they're pretty down about it, you get that side of it as well. He's not able to hide it. I've seen this in him before. It's not a new thing with the media. He can be quite antagonistic from time to time. And when we've interviewed him, you know, behind the scenes, he does enjoy a competitive debate, and he will go backwards and forwards. And the one thing that I will say is he does try to listen. He's a very emotional person. He's not able to hide how he feels when he feels particularly strong about something. So, I mean, I don't agree with everything that he says, but I agree with some of the things that he says. And I just think because you don't agree with some of the things, it doesn't mean you should discount everything that he says.
No.
I mean, he's been talking about this. This isn't a new issue. This has been going on for the last 5 years since he arrived in England. And I think part of it boils down to the fact that even though they won the league last season, Liverpool, and they navigated their way superbly through that winter period, he hates this period of the season when there's just so many games, because it goes back to the fact that, you know, in Germany they have a 2-week winter break, and he does find it quite hard and perhaps a bit emotionally draining as well. So I do see his points on the bigger issues, but just as much as he's sort of campaigning on behalf of Liverpool, really. I know he's saying that he's making the point about, you know, for the greater good of football, but ultimately it's through the prism of Liverpool, isn't it? And I think that when it's particularly a Liverpool manager, I think the argument becomes a bit harder, really, because obviously Liverpool are the team that everybody wants to beat, and I don't think neutral fans really want Liverpool to win the league this season, so his argument isn't being heard quite as much at the moment.
I mean, my personal feeling is that Des Kelly, who did the interview for BT, is the best post-match interviewer that there is. I think he because of his journalistic background, I think he's really well prepared, and he knows where the arguments are going to come, as he would have done, obviously, with that Jurgen Klopp. I found myself watching it and thinking it is possible to both agree and disagree with each of them over the course of that 8-minute conversation, actually.
Yeah, I suppose you ask the point, you ask yourself the point. What is the whole point of a post-match interview?
So many
interviews just go through the motions, don't they? And at least it did present, I think, from the manager's point of view, it obviously became very clear about how he feels. And equally, for the television company's point of view, you can understand that point of view. I just think two seasons ago, around this time, Jurgen spoke a lot about the Africa Cup of Nations being held in the summer and the impact that would have, you know, about players just not getting a rest. I remember him speaking about Sadio Mane being a special case in football. He's almost indestructible, isn't he? I know he gave him a rest at the game against Brighton, but he's been talking about this for a long time, and this frustration's been building up inside him, and I think he feels that nobody's listening. So I think from his point of view, even though he's obviously going to take some stick and, you know, some of it fair off the back of this, at least it's provoking the discussion. And at least now we've seen articles in I think there's one in the Times today about how, you know, the Premier League and the broadcasters aren't particularly impressed with Jurgen Klopp, but at least it might bring the two of them to the same table together so they can actually talk about it. Because that hasn't really happened as much as Jurgen, I think, would like.
That was Des Kelly's point, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Don't fire your anger at me or at us. Fire it at the Premier League to get around the table with the broadcasters and work it out. Let's move on to your article, because it is absolutely fantastic insight into the scouting system that has been devised at Liverpool, overseen by sporting director Michael Edwards, who actually comes across as quite hands-off in the piece.
He's got a huge responsibility at Liverpool. He's got the keys of the club, really. Even the whole idea is that this system would work regardless of who the manager is. I think that's what Liverpool wants. It's quite clear that Jurgen Klopp, without him, I don't think it would have worked. I think they need needed that front man, that the person who's got the experience to drive the football team for. But behind the scenes, there's obviously an extensive network of scouting, which I think at this point in time is much stronger than it was 5 years ago, not just because of the success of the football team, but just because of the element of time that over a long period of time, the club's been able to build up this database that they have and have a greater understanding of which players suit what they need. So as I've sort of alluded to in the piece, it's not just Michael Edwards, it's Jurgen Klopp, it's the owners, the chief scout and the head of strategy, Barry Hunter and Dave Fallows. They're hugely influential figures within it. At the moment, you know, the system works perfectly because I think everybody's fighting towards the same end. I think it didn't work under the previous manager when it seemed like he'd sort of lost his way in terms of how he wanted the team to play and what sort of players he was looking for. At the moment, because of Jurgen Klopp's demands are so clear in terms of what he expects out of a fullback or a midfielder, it becomes a lot easier for the scouts to do their job and look for what he needs in the team, because Jurgen Klopp's team and sort of the build-up of the team, it hasn't really changed a great deal over the last sort of 5 years. It's always been a 4-3-3. And I think when you've got that level of consistency in the team selection, it becomes a lot easier to look for what you want. The thing is about the piece, I mean, I just think it comes across quite clear that Liverpool get the basics right.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a few people as ever sort of on social media sort of saying, oh, well, there's nothing, you know, sort of that sort of revolutionary there. But I think it's because of the consistency that they have at the top end of the club and getting the basic decisions right, the stuff that you should be doing and doing that to a very good standard. It means that Liverpool are possibly just a bit ahead of other clubs at the moment. I think Leicester, obviously very good with their recruitment as well, which ironically, you know, it's quite ironic given we mentioned Brendan Rodgers, but behind the scenes, they've been very good over a number of years, knowing when to buy, when to sell and reinvest that money. So I'd say those two clubs at the moment are probably a little bit ahead of the others in terms of the recruitment strategy.
One of the key words you mentioned there was time, and you see a lot of clubs chopping and changing around their recruitment, around their sporting director type role. Let's not forget that it's not so long ago that Liverpool's so-called transfer committee was the laughing stock. It was derided within football, and now it's seen as the gold standard, the sort of the model that everybody aspires to. Also, a point you mentioned within the piece is that Michael Edwards needed to be happy with the appointment of Jurgen Klopp, which is mind-blowing to think when you imagine the quality and stature of Jurgen Klopp as a manager and this sort of intelligent guy coming up through the likes of Portsmouth, Tottenham and then Liverpool needing to be satisfied with the appointment of Klopp. But they've actually done it the right way. They've got the structure in place first, the head coach fits into that, and over time it's got to the point it's at now. You can't just produce this or reproduce it at another club overnight.
No, it does take a lot of time. And I was as critical as anyone, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago when it didn't seem like it was working. But I, this isn't revisionism. I still think that the criticism was deserved at that time. There was elements of the club that weren't clicking, which meant that the signings that they were making didn't look good and the results on the pitch were affected by that. At this time, they were doing some elements. I think there was some elements of the strategy at that point that were right, but obviously wasn't working because the results on the pitch weren't there. Now, at the time when Jurgen Klopp came in, there were some question marks about him because I think he was seen from afar as being this, you know, this big sort of, I suppose what we've seen in over the last couple of days in front of the TV camera is quite bombastic. And can he, is he sort of somebody who's prepared to sort of delegate and let people get on with the jobs, and or does he want to take over the whole club? And I think that was a misconception, because as soon as they met him, they realised that, you know, he doesn't want to be, his fingerprints are across everything that happens at Liverpool, but day to day, week to week, everyone who sort of works at Liverpool is allowed to get on with their jobs. And it goes back to what you were saying about Michael Edwards. I mean, part of the piece is about sort of his relationship with the scouts, and he's not in touch with them on a day-to-day basis. They are just trusted to go and do what they're expected to do. And, you know, he'll only be in touch with them if he's got a query. He won't be phoning them up, asking them where they are, who they're going to speak to. All he wants to see is the data, or sorry, the scouting report, which is still delivered in a very sort of traditional way, albeit online, into a system. And then what happens from that point onwards is the data analyst team, which is another piece that should be written really about how they look at the data and marry that with what the scouts are saying and what they're seeing and all the feedback coming back from those reports. So there's a good mix at the moment between the traditional form of scouting and the data-led stuff, which is allowing them to make more rounded decisions. I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago, there was an impression, rightly or wrongly, that it was being led too much by the data. I think now they would argue that wasn't the case at the time. But I think now it's without doubt that you've got the good mix of people who aren't necessarily data-led, but are more impressionist-led. And the data specialist who understands how to use maths and figures.
And presumably scout first, analytics second. Do the analysts sometimes go, wow, this data on this player looks amazing. Yeah. Do you want to go and have a look at him?
Yeah, it does sometimes happen that way.
Right, okay.
If the data looks particularly spectacular, the scouts will be encouraged to go and look at that player. But likewise, a scout might come back with a report on a player who, I don't know, has made his debut in one of the European leagues and they don't know so much about it. And from that point onwards, if the report is a good one, the data will then kick in and they'll do as much data research as they can. So it's a mix, really. I think they've definitely got the balance right at the moment, because I think if you go too far with one, we've seen it at other clubs. I think that there are other clubs who've gone full data. I mean, there's Bolton Wanderers, maybe a bad comparison because they're in League Two, but they I know they've gone big into the data over the last couple of years, and it hasn't quite worked for them.
The other thing that I notice, and honestly, you cheeky so and so, I don't know why you had to bring Manchester United into your article, but anyhow, hey, I felt like it was just personally winding me up. But there is an interesting comparison that you make there, which is United have posted scouts, certainly up until last year, as you say, in so many different countries across the globe that takes them to over 80 scouts. Liverpool do it slightly differently with what you say 12 to 15, but they're responsible for two or three countries or sub-regions and then areas in England as well to presumably give them a bit of variety.
Yeah. Well, that's it. The feeling at Liverpool is that by having a scout, say, in every significant football country, the job becomes too much of a routine. You know, sometimes when you're across everything, you're across less in some ways, because the job becomes routine. You don't challenge your opinion quite as much as you would if you're sort of ducking and ducking in and out of a certain country or a league. From the top, there's a view that at Liverpool, it keeps the mind a lot sharper and a lot fresher. And I was speaking to a scout who's worked for another Premier League club, and he said that the ideal of the job is that you want to go into a stadium on any given weekend and believe that you might see something that somebody else hasn't seen before, or you know, you've got to be excited when you go inside the stadium. And there's an impression perhaps that other clubs, maybe Manchester United, if they're seeing the same players and the same teams every single weekend, it's you know, that sort of level of excitement, it's not there. So I think there's different ways of looking at it. I'm sure that, you know, if that's not necessarily the sole reason for United's recruitment strategy not quite kicking in at the moment. But you know, under there might be other tweaks to the system that United could make that that would make it more successful.
At Liverpool, could a scout, I mean, maybe I'm taking this to a slight extreme, but could a scout be responsible for Norfolk, Suffolk and Uruguay?
Yeah, the north, there can be the north of England and then part of the Balkans areas. You know,
right,
and
okay, right.
It just depends what the priority is as well in terms of what is on that week. So there are some scouts that I'm aware, you know, don't cover their regions as regularly as they basically got a primary job and then a secondary job. So the primary job will be where Liverpool expect to find more players. The secondary job might be less than that. So, I mean, you mentioned Uruguay there in South America at the moment. Liverpool have increased the scouting operation in that region because I think this is sort of reflective of how things are. I think at one point a couple of years ago, the two Manchester clubs had 27 scouts between them operating full-time in South America. Liverpool have just gradually moved that up to 4 full-time scouts. But it's not just about sort of signing players from South America. It's about having a data backlog of reports. So Roberto Firmino is an example of it. He was a player who was scouted by Liverpool's South American scout, Fernando Troiani, going back 7, 8, 9 years ago when he was pretty much when he was on trial at Sao Paulo. So it meant that when he was doing well for Hoffenheim, all years later, they were able to look back at those scout reports and form a bigger impression of the person, you know, who his family are. It's not just about the performance. A lot of it is down to, you know, who they're surrounded by and the personality. Because Liverpool don't sign players that don't fit into the sort of the ethos that the Klopp wants in the dressing room as well. So that really does help.
If the need is there for the coming transfer window, what sort of process will be gone through, and has the work on the recruitment side already been done by this point, so close to a transfer window?
Not everything works out the way the scouting department expects it to. They obviously sort of have a long-term strategy. They're always working 2 or 3 windows ahead, but you can't legislate for the number of injuries that Liverpool have had this season. It's just been incredible, hasn't it? You know, they're obviously missing 6, 7, 8 players at the moment, and that might cause them to change routes. But what is certain is they won't just sign a player who, for the sake of filling a position, they won't want to sign a player who might jeopardise the chances of getting an even better player in the long term. So I think we've obviously discussed it before about the player at Leipzig, Upamecano, they do really like. If they can, you know, if they can get him in January, in the summer, it will be interesting to see whether that'll affect exactly what they do in January. The list of targets is never defined. It can change within the context of a couple of months according to what the player's done or according to what's going on at Liverpool as well.
But by this point, would it be in the hands of Michael Edwards, Jurgen Klopp, Mike Gordon, as opposed to the deeper recruitment network as for January?
Yeah, it's right at the top. I mean,
yeah.
No decision is ever made without, if Jurgen Klopp's uncomfortable with the decision, they will never sign a player, he'll never have a player forced upon him. I don't want to say it's an unprecedented moment, but it's obviously an extreme version of what can happen when you've got lots of injuries and you've got massive pressure on the squad. I think it might prompt Liverpool to do something that potentially they wouldn't have done 2 or 3 months ago, just because, you know, that they are running out of players at the moment. Jurgen Klopp, obviously, he uses exaggeration to make his point sometimes, and sometimes you've got to take it with a pinch of salt. But if he is genuinely concerned about Liverpool's squad being able to finish the season to a competitive standard because of the number of injuries that they've got at the moment, which you would think will only increase throughout this period, through December and January when they've got so many games. You know, that's going to put pressure on the transfer budget and the transfer activity. But I do think that Liverpool won't waver too far from the long-term strategy. I think they'll be trying to push. If they are going to go and try and sign players, they'll be trying to sign players that they have always wanted, not just players that will fill a space for the next couple of months.
That's brilliant, Simon. Thank you.
Simon, thank you, mate.
No problem.
Let's move on to Newcastle on the pod now. We're joined by The Athletic's Chris Waugh, who covers the Newcastle beat. I mean, it's, well, 72 hours probably at least since Newcastle's big win on Friday night when we're recording this. So you must still be basking in the glory of that performance, Chris.
Well, it was a million times better than it's been recently, but that probably says a lot more about how Newcastle have played in recent weeks. Because for 85 minutes, the game itself was pretty dire. I mean, Newcastle were better, and I think that was more just the game and the spectacle in general. That tends to be, when you watch Newcastle this season, most games have been pretty non... There haven't been any entertainment value whatsoever for both teams. But I thought that as an all-round performance in terms of certainly defensively, they were a lot better. They looked better in attack. And then the fact that they got the 2-0 win, the result so often dictates how people feel. If it finished nils each, or if they'd lost 1-0 in the end, then I think there would have been a lot of frustration on Tyneside. But at least they got to celebrate over the weekend. It was a 2-0 win. It puts them sort of comfortably mid-table again, and the pressure eases a little bit.
Still pragmatic, though, wasn't it? It wasn't exactly gung-ho. I spoke to Steve Bruce on Saturday. I did say, you know, sometimes do you just think, sod it, let's go for it. And he said, you just can't do that, because much as you might want to, you're going to get picked off. I mean, I do doubt whether Crystal Palace would have picked them off, but you can see his point. A lot of Newcastle fans might not, but you can see his point.
Part of the frustration earlier on in the season was that Newcastle weren't being gung-ho by any stretch, but also they were sitting off so much and yet being picked off anyway, so they were being defensive and conceding goals and opportunities anyway. So the fact that they were basically being so passive and ceding the territory was irrelevant in terms of that they were still conceding opportunities. They just weren't creating any themselves. So what it was really good about Friday night was at least they were getting higher up the pitch, they were getting bodies higher up the pitch, and they had support up front, whereas players have been really isolated in recent weeks attack. And yes, it wasn't the finished article by any stretch, and it's just one game. We'll see over the course of the next few weeks, when they've got some really important matches coming up, whether they can actually start to score goals more regularly. But it was certainly more encouraging than we've seen in recent weeks.
Well, talking of goals, it looks like finally Newcastle have once again got a promising strike partnership in the making. And you mentioned those games coming up. Goodness me, they could really rack some points together if they continue to build those partnerships and continue that sort of positive trajectory.
Yeah, well, the encouraging thing about Friday night, and I wrote about this on The Athletic, was that we saw one of Joe Linton's best all-round performances for Newcastle. Yeah. And it was only one 90-minute game, and it will be highlighted that he had the majority of their shots and most of them were awful. And that is the real the real issue with him. The goal scoring and shooting still remains a problem. And his goal actually came via a tame shot and then a deflection.
I don't want to be miserable here, but even his goal was a pretty awful shot.
Yeah, it was, and well, and this is what we've seen so much from him. And last season, when he did play up front for a large part of the season, and to be fair on Steve Bruce, he didn't have that many options because Dwight Gayle was injured for most of the season. Obviously, they didn't sign Salomon Rondon the summer before, and so Joe Linton was made to play as this centre forward, which he never was before. He's never a lone centre forward previously, and he's coming to a new country in a team which doesn't create many opportunities. He was so isolated, and you really did feel for him for a large part of last season, but also from a Newcastle point of view, it just was not working. And he was taken out of the team for a little bit. He was played as a left winger at parts. And Steve Bruce himself even suggested that he could be a left winger going forward. And it just never really seemed that was the place to fit him. He's now playing as a second striker or number 10. And he's played there a few times, all are spread out. But each time he has done, he's looked far better. And having someone alongside him like Callum Wilson, who takes the goal-scoring burden off him, I think that really has helped his all-round game.
There are two subjects, aren't there, really, that I imagine you discuss all the time on Pod on the Tyne, which is, one, where are Newcastle's goals going to come from? Tick, we've done that. Secondly, what's happening with Mike Ashley? So tick, we'll do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, goals, as you alluded to, is Callum Wilson. In terms of Mike Ashley, that is the unanswerable question at the minute, and he can't even tell anyone that. Not that he speaks ever or is clear in his intentions, but at the moment we've had the takeover attempt from the Saudi-led group, and that didn't happen during the summer. July, they pulled out, having not got beyond the owners and directors test. Since then, we've had various different things going on in the background. We've had political movements. There's been fans group themselves have actually tried to push the Premier League for answers and for clarity, and I try to take them to the Competition Commission. Then you also have Mike Ashley and Newcastle United themselves, who took the extraordinary step the other week of, for the second time in the matter of a few weeks, calling out the Premier League, of whom they are one of 20 members, and basically saying how they have taken the Premier League to arbitration. So we don't know exactly what the arbitration is trying to achieve, whether it is ownership or ownership change, or whether it is compensation, or exactly what it is, but all the parties remain interested. Mike Ashley still wants to sell up for about £305 million, and so the whole club remains in this sort of limbo stasis where nobody knows exactly what's going to happen in the short to medium term, never mind the long term. And so Mike Ashley still hangs over the club.
There were reports over the weekend of a potential COVID outbreak. As we record now, a lot of people at Newcastle are waiting for test results back before they know if they can resume training today. Players, staff, is that a serious concern that could derail things for Steve Bruce?
It is a serious concern. I mean, Newcastle, until basically the most recent international break, had been pretty good at not having too wide a spread of COVID. They were one of the earliest clubs to introduce the washing of hands at training grounds long before others did. I think it was early February. And they've had protocols in place throughout the whole pandemic. But then since the international break, they've had a few cases around the first team group. I think it's up to 5 confirmed cases now. And so, yeah, they cancelled training over the weekend. Players had to arrive at the training ground in their cars, and they had swabs for extra tests to see whether they've contained this break or whether it is a wider spread within the group. So preparations for Friday night at Aston Villa have already been disrupted. But I mean, if it does turn out to be a significant outbreak, then certainly Steve Bruce may end up selecting a makeshift team. Or beyond that, if it does really turn out to be prevalent, then I suppose the game itself could come into doubt at a later stage this week.
God, never a dull moment at St James's Park.
Just a final one on the limbo that you spoke about. If there is limbo regards the ownership, what Newcastle fans will fear is that means complete inactivity in January.
Yeah, and that remains the concern. Steve Bruce, I know privately, is trying to push for assurances that he can strengthen, because he did want a centre-back in the summer, as David himself reported, that they tried to get Rob Holding on loan from Arsenal. That was pretty much agreed until Arsenal pulled the plug. He still wants a centre-back. He would like a central midfielder. They really lack dynamism in the middle of the park. And so the fact that they've still got 2 domestic loans, I think, is important, because I think regardless of what happens with the ownership, they will push to use them. And even if Mike Ashley doesn't release funds, because in the summer transfer budget was significantly reduced, 30 to 40 million down because of the pandemic, I think that they will look to bring in at least 1 or 2 bodies on loan, but permanent signings may have to wait a little bit longer.
We will let you go to continue to bask in the glow of victory.
Thank
until
you very much.
Villa Park.
Oh, you always have to bring it down, don't you? Nah, sorry about
luck.
Him. Sorry about him, Chris.
That's all right. We're used to that sort of thing.
Don't forget, by the way, Alan Shearer, now a columnist on The Athletic. You can read his interview there right now with Frank Lampard as they talk about Roman Abramovich's support, rebuilding Chelsea and dropping stars. Now, don't forget, David's YouTube video drops on Wednesday. I'm back Thursday alongside Matt Slater for the Business of Sport podcast. And David and I will be back with this pod next Tuesday. Thanks for listening.
Have a good week.